Hello, the internet, and welcome to this episode of the Weekly Zeitgeist. These are some of our favorite segments from this week, all edited together into one nonstop infotainment laugh extravaganza. So without further ado, here is the Weekly Zeitgeist. Lucas, what is something from your search history that is revealing about who you are?
Revealing about me, I guess, just the last thing that I Google searched was images of Joseph Stalin.
Just a big fan.
No.
Love Joseph Stalin.
Love his work.
Love, yeah. Big, well, you know, efficient. Efficient and
no.
Thorough.
Yeah.
Left
a job half complete.
My wife's relationship to houseflies is sort of most similar to Joseph Stalin's relationship to the Russian, you know, rural class.
So she, like...
She crushes them.
She crushes them. Got
She's furious at their insubordination, and she's constantly making lists.
Okay. You know, got it.
Yeah, so I was looking up for a good image that I was like, this is you. This is who you are.
Right.
And it's sort of like him in military uniform, sort of in the middle end of his career.
We have this podcast, Behind the Bastard, hosted by a guy, Robert Evans, where he has this theory that it's actually Joseph Stalin's handsomeness and a lot of these different dictators' handsomeness that caused them.
He was really good looking.
He was a really
kid.
Handsome
If you look
dude.
Up young Joseph Stalin,
yeah,
you're going to be like, totally have signed up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing with like CEOs. Or we were talking about Elon Musk being really tall earlier. There's like some average height of CEOs that they're almost all over 6 feet tall.
Right.
Really?
Which is just like, we like tall,
we like
good looking people.
Charisma, mm-hmm. You know? And also, I think it's also partially, there's that 30 Rock episode, The Bubble, where Jon Hamm is so good looking that nobody tells him he's a terrible doctor or a terrible cook. And I wonder how much of it is just them sort of just everybody being like, yeah, man, that's great. You're crushing it, Joseph Stalin.
I think we all live in a bubble.
Yeah.
I think we're all actually in a bubble that's almost completely filled with sort of like delusions of some measure.
Well, you think we're living in a...
I don't think we're living in a simulation.
Okay, that's good.
I don't think
that's
that.
Good.
I think this is very real. I adhere to the Raymond Talis view of life.
What
is
that?
He's a polymath, and he's like, all these theories about time and everything are really great, but at the end of the day, you're still late for the bus. I think that
that's deep.
Things are a lot simpler than we. I mean, in LA, no one's late for the bus really because you know, almost no. There are no buses practically, but I mean, people take it. But
yeah,
it's just that there's certain life in some ways and time is simpler than we like to imagine because I think more complicated theories offer us the possibility of less mortality,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of very seductive.
Yeah,
but I don't think it's true.
At the same time, really complicated math gave us the atomic bomb, which was very real.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
somewhere
in
between.
Well, I think math is real.
Yeah, I agree. So Trump was doing his Trump thing at a rally at the end of last week, and people started paying attention to the people behind him because he's just on auto-repeat, animatronic Trump, just spitting out the same, all the hits. So people's attention drifts to what's going on behind him. And there was a young lady, you know, respecting the shit out of the flag, wiping her nose on it, which for some reason people didn't object to that, even though that's the sort of thing that if an NFL player did it, whoo, man. They would freak out. But anyways.
They'd have a real tough time if Tom Brady did it. It'd be tough to figure out how to feel about that.
Right.
Right.
You know, I mean, a lot of people would be really confused.
Yeah. Kneeling is disrespectful for the flag, but you can stick that shit all the way up your nose.
Right.
Yeah.
On national television.
Mm-hmm. I do feel really bad for her because she looks like she's, you know, middle school age person and is probably getting a lot of shit. But she's also at a Trump rally, so that's on her. So there's also this dude who was like right over Trump's right ear, who seemed to be, you know, reacting appropriately because he was like, what? At a couple points, like literally mouthing the words what after Trump said something particularly wild and was like looking into the middle distance, like just kind of shocked and horrified as to what the president was saying. And but not like overly so, like he wasn't like hamming it up really. And then at a certain point, a young woman who looked... She really has the same look as Kavanaugh's assistant who was sitting behind him and Dana Loesch. She's got like that straight brunette hair look that there's apparently like a factory for conservative women that churns these folks out. But she comes up and just like moves him out of the, she's just like, you have to leave. And he's like escorted out the other direction. And then there are these other people, a couple dudes wearing MAGA hats who aren't doing anything really bad, but a pretty Trump staffer comes up and replaces them and begins just smiling like a cheerleader. It's just like, yes. And then another woman comes up and is smiling. So they want the optics of, you know, enthusiastic Trump-supporting women, and they don't want any sort of dissonance. But it ended up having the vibe of real, like, invasion of the body snatcher shit.
And I'd like to take credit, though, because those women came from my new modeling school, Make America Beautiful Again. I'm sure you've heard it on the radio.
MABA.
On your, MABA. I'm sure you've heard of us on the radio. We're going to have a convention at the Marriott next week. Bring your checks. But, like, it's crazy because also what they're saying is that, like, look, you real ugly-ass Trump supporters got to get the hell out of the way. Like, they replaced them with complete plans. Like, there was a girl who was just being quiet, loving Trump. You know what I mean? Like, she looked like she came straight out of a Hot Topic and threw on that MAGA hat.
Right.
And they were like, oh, no, sis, get your goth ass out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
Give me somebody who looks like they love God.
Right.
God and the Aryan race. Well, let me get Tina, but, get over here.
Yeah, the most white woman you can
find. Right, yeah. And apparently ever since the Manafort and Cohen guilty pleas, the energy at these events has been down and...
Really?
Yeah.
No, I thought they would. It would never change. I thought there was nothing that could
shake
them.
Such a deep denial.
Yeah. Like, just, I mean, like, doesn't matter. I thought still nothing able mattered.
They're still able to fill the places, so it's not like it.
Are they filling it, or are they calling central casting?
Yeah.
I mean, from beginning, right? It was always central casting, right?
Well, at the beginning, it was central casting, but then it started being pretty authentically a groundswell. But now it seems like it might be going back to them having to, you know, stick staffers here and there to kind of pep things up because everyone's like, oh, he's talking about this shit again. So I don't know.
I mean, the level of artifice in politics in general is, I mean, it's across the board.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
If you think that either of our major political parties aren't like handpicking every single person you see on camera as much as possible,
right?
And Joe, like, the plumber.
You know, like you look at the convention in 2016. I want to say last year, but with Hillary, and you're like, it is the most like overt diversity, Here is a woman, and here is a Middle Eastern American.
They just called Dove, and we're like, who did y'all have in that
and
commercial?
And then someone's there's like a league of like a cappella singers in wheelchairs. And, and you're like, this is a better message, but it's just as, to some extent, feels just as artificial to me.
Yeah,
because it's meant to manipulate us into thinking a certain thing about the candidate.
At the same time, weird to me. Yeah. I guess it's just the idea that who you're replacing them with.
Oh, yeah.
Is just
their idea of
good. Yeah, they didn't roll anybody in.
Super alarming.
And it is this. Know? Yeah. There's something about that aesthetic. I mean, you could almost, it's progressive for Republicans to have a dark-haired woman instead of a blonde-haired woman.
They've
look
seen
out.
How big Kim Kardashian's got. Right. They're like, look, the goddamn Jenners aren't going anywhere. Right. Like, get us a brunette.
Yeah, well, it's still like Betty and Veronica, like, levels of diversity.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, whoa, different. Watch out now.
Brunette. Whoa. But yeah,
I think brunettes
Archie,
are in
what are you
for
thinking?
The Repubs.
It's not the artifice that gets to me, because I agree with you, Lucas. It is. It does cross party lines. And sometimes it is nice to see yourself represented on TV.
No, it's great
TV,
to see that representation.
In this manner, because this is obviously not like acting. You know what I mean? That is just seeing people on television. But what's interesting to me is like how they go about it. Like, I want this shit to be behind the scenes.
Yeah,
like, y'all knew where
the
podium was. Y'all knew who was going to be standing behind Trump. And y'all let this old... His eyes look dodgy as fuck. Like, they should have known he was not supposed to be standing behind the president.
It's like the Wizard of Oz, where you're like, really? You put the curtain in the controls directly next to the hologram.
Right.
Like you could have had like a separate room nearby. Like at least like Ed Harris was in the moon watching Truman. You know what I mean? Like he had a little bit of distance. You weren't gonna see him in the same shot. You know, he wasn't like walking behind Jim Carrey being like, okay, let's get another pretty lady over here. And then, but you know, it was a little bit more covert.
Right. Which and they weren't even
feels like they
about
respect
it.
Your intelligence a little bit more, yeah, right? You that's want them true. To respect you with their lies.
And Trump doesn't give a fuck. His lies have become so lazy. And like these, that's what I mean. I'm like, come on, you can't even act like we're looking at you right now. Like y'all like, fuck it.
Well, yeah, he's mastered the superpower of being able to come up with a lazy lie and believe it himself immediately.
It's a talent.
It's really beautiful. It is September 11th, Tuesday, the same day the original attacks happened on, and
fucking 17 years.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah. I was just thinking about this, and I think I've read other people reflecting on the same thing, that the longer we go, it was actually the Frank Rich article that was about how 2008 was like a turning point in American history. And he was like, if you stood in the ashes of the Twin Towers the day, like on September 12th, and I told you in 17 years there wouldn't be another like major terror attack, you'd be like, well, great, we won. Like everything's great. And then he goes on to make the point that, you know, actually the most significant event of the past 20 years was the 2008 stock market crash. But just in terms of...
Yeah, or the Iraq War.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, if you really want to take it there, I think that whole war, I mean, completely destabilized the region for many years to come.
Yeah. I guess specifically American history. But yeah, the longer we go, it seems like the more anomalous this looks. Like it may go down as, I don't know, I was trying to think of like some equivalent because it was like such a, you know, huge and all consuming, spectacular event when it happened, that like, what is there a historical equivalent of something like that that was just an anomaly? And I was thinking like the Trojan horse thing or something like that, where it's just like a really lucky strike that took advantage of a key weakness that we just like weren't kind of aware of.
Mm-hmm. Or ignore. I think it's so hard. I don't know.
When that happened, I was only 14 or 15 years old or something like that. So my mind couldn't grasp the gravity of that entire thing like it would today. But just to think like how those attacks were just laid out over the day is so insane that couldn't have been random. That was just, like you said, an ignoring of something we should have saw coming.
There were a lot of, there like, seemed to be a lot of warnings from the intelligence community that was happening.
Right.
It was, when you say that it becomes more obscure, what do you mean? That we're becoming more and more detached of like from...
No, just like more, I think I assumed that this was going to be the new reality, that there was just going to be more and more terror attacks in America. Mm-hmm. And like, especially like in the aftermath, there was the anthrax attacks and I was in DC at the time. And it just seemed like everyone was like, oh yeah, like this is just the beginning of, you know, there was going to be a war on terror, but the terror was going to be fighting a war back on the United States. And, you know, there have been mass shootings and isolated terror attacks here and there, but nothing on the scale. There was also I think it was an editorial in the few years immediately following September 11th, where they talked about how it was basically a 50-50 proposition that somebody was going to blow up a major U.S. city with a rogue nuclear weapon, like in the next decade.
And everyone was talking about dirty bombs.
Yeah,
and stuff.
It just seemed like, okay, this is how things are going to be from now on. And the fact that it has kind of gone into history as this like huge crazy thing that happened on U.S. soil that we haven't seen a sequel to, I guess, is what I mean. That like it's not the context I would have expected looking back 17 years from now at the time.
Yeah, well, I think it just gave a lot of pretext for a lot of other shit to happen. So like gave a pretext for war, gave a pretext for unwarranted surveillance on the people of the U.S. It justified people's Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. The effects of it are so, when you think about where we are today, and you can kind of be like, oh yeah, 9/11 had a lot to do with that.
Yeah,
or like at least changing the thinking of American people. Like, yeah, I think a lot of the tangible event stuff, like, yeah, there may not have been another attack or things like that, but it fundamentally
changed
the culture
in a
way that we're still wrestling with.
I mean, it changed the culture in a way that even our current president is, the rhetoric
yeah. Right.
Is toxic and vile because of that day.
Yeah, and then we began commodifying the whole patriotism idea thing too, just making that right. whole.
Yeah, that's something else that I was thinking about on September 11th in particular, that it doesn't seem like we have a good unifying like way to recognize the anniversary of September 11th. Like, I feel like all of the things that have become associated with recognizing September 11th are things from the right, like, you know, NASCAR rallies and right. football and, you know, respect our flag and stuff. And it just seems like there could be something that the whole country could agree on and get behind.
Right.
Like, you, I think you were talking at one point about how Japan has a nationwide moment of silence.
Yeah, for like Nagasaki, Hiroshima, like at the moments where those bombs were dropped, there's a moment of silence. There's another one on March 11th for the tsunami.
Right.
So, yeah, it's weird. I mean, like in Europe, you see it too. Like, I know Remembrance Day before like the football matches, you see proper, like, it's really interesting to see an entire stadium, like even with rival fans, just figuring out like, okay, shut the fuck up for a second. And
right.
let's take a moment to be solemn here and reflective on everything.
I think too, like in today's society, that we are so quick to move on to the next thing.
Right.
Where, you know, 2001, 2003, those subsequent years after the attack, it was, we were just a different society where we didn't, the 24-hour news cycle wasn't as prevalent as it is today, or social media wasn't even a thing, or all this type of stuff, that if that was going to happen for us,
mm-hmm.
that moment is past, I think, right. because now it's just like, okay, 9/11, yeah. let's reflect.
Well, those, yeah.
But then tomorrow there will be something else.
Well, right. But even in those years following, I felt like there was still this idea of like, we still were connected to it a little bit, and we're like,
yeah,
that was a dark time.
Right.
And it did have, it did bring people together for sure, because it was just such a horrific event. But yeah, not to the point where like, I think now as time goes on, we're just a little bit more and more, we've distanced ourselves a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, even though when I go to New York and stuff and I go to the memorial there,
yeah.
there's still very much, you can feel it there. You know, can. Like, you can understand just the gravity of the situation. But yeah, I think nationally, I'm surprised that we don't really, I don't know.
You don't
if
feel
it's a,
it.
If it's a thing where, but I mean, I don't know. Are there real days of like national tragedy that America really has kind of took stock of? I mean, like, hold on now.
Right.
Because I mean, like, December 7th for Pearl Harbor, it's like a, people are like, oh, yeah, today's December 7th.
Yeah. I think that kind of ebbed.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
It was a thing for a while. And then, you know, now people are just, it's more of a piece of trivia, I feel like.
Yeah.
Where people are like, oh, you know, today was
Pearl Harbor.
But I don't know.
Day.
Maybe that's that D-Day. Speaks to the idea of American resilience, too, that it's like,
right.
we're going to move forward. So we don't need to get hung up. But at
right.
the same time, you know, that I think of what the world looked like on September 10th, 2001, and how different that was. And then
right.
how that kicked off this whole other thing.
I mean, even that morning, like, this is a little bit of a funny story, but even that morning for me was just different from the end of that day. And like I said, I didn't have the mental capacity to understand the gravity of what was going on. But that morning, September 11th, I woke up that morning, go to school, and that was the morning that I found out Michael Jordan was coming back to play for the Wizards. And so I was distraught.
Did he announce that?
He didn't announce it that day. He didn't announce it that day, but that's the day I found out that it was about to happen.
Right.
I think he officially signed the contract like a couple of days later or a few days later or something like that. But that was the day on ESPN where they announced Michael Jordan is seriously considering a comeback.
Wow, I didn't even
And
realize
I was distraught.
That was around the same time. Right.
I was distraught.
So 9/11 has a different meaning for you.
So, well, it now it means what it's supposed to mean. But I went to school that day pissed, like, how dare he come back to the Wizards? This was bullshit. And my Spanish teacher opened up the class second period. It was like, today is just such a sad day. And at this point, I hadn't known about 9/11 yet. And I was like, man, it ain't that damn serious, guys. Like,
right.
Michael Jordan just coming. It's fine, guys.
Wow.
And then, like, it was like, no, there was a terror attack. And I was like, oh.
This sounds like a rejected SNL sketch.
Yeah, seriously.
I was like, oh, that's what happened.
Huh.
And, like, the rest of the day was just such a weird day.
Yeah.
Just hearing all this stuff trickle in and seeing the fear in people. And at this point, I'm in Chicago, so.
Yeah.
Like, the Sears Tower was one of the targets. And so, like, gas prices started rocketing up and all this shit. So, Like, the rest of that day just, and it put it in perspective, it puts it in perspective for me now, like, what I was distraught about at the beginning of the day compared to what actually happened.
Right, right.
Is just so insane how much of a difference the feeling of myself and everybody was from when we woke up that morning to when we went to sleep that night.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And as a nation, famously, Time Magazine had The Summer of the Shark as their cover
in the weeks
before, because there had been two shark attacks that summer.
Mm.
But they were kind of high profile, and like a pretty young woman like had one of her arms or legs bitten off while surfing. And so they were high profile, and so they were like, this will go down as the summer of the shark. And then September 11th happened.
Aaliyah died a month before that.
Yep.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I was at Disneyland with my grandparents.
Really?
Yeah.
I had just landed when her plane crashed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was the first time I'd ever flown.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
So it's the one and only time I experienced the airport without TSA.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. A gentleman by the name of Barack Obama is back, you guys. He gave a speech at the University of Illinois that had just some great rhetoric that would unite us all if half the country wasn't just like bouncing on the balls of their feet, just ready to jump on whatever he says and be offended by it. But his overall message was that Trump's not America's biggest problem. America's biggest problem is indifference. Which was a nice, refreshing message, I think, because it's something that people can actually solve and do something about, as opposed to the news cycle and just the zeitgeist in general these days makes people feel a little bit helpless and like they don't really have any control over the world or, you know, the news cycle. And I think his point was, you know, get out there and vote. Did you guys hear the speech, hear any parts of it?
I heard it. And by heard, I mean I read quotes on Twitter.
Yes. There you go.
So it's practically like Barack was like sitting next to me.
Right.
Did anything reach you? Did anything move you or affect you?
I mean, he's always a moving speaker. And I've seen him and heard him speak a ton of times. And what he's saying is not stuff that I guess I'm unfamiliar with. So I was just like, okay, cool, cool. Yeah, we should be voting. Yeah, we shouldn't be getting, you know, complacent or cynic or... Cynical. Thank you. My brain is not functioning on full form yet. But I don't know. I think Trump could get a second term.
Yeah, no, I think it's totally possible.
It feels almost inevitable.
Yeah. I don't know. So some part of me this morning was like, ah, shit, this is really going to rev up the Trump base. But people were saying that that's not necessarily true, that he's gone out and stumped for liberal candidates in the past, and it hasn't like gotten the Republicans out anymore. It's just their levels of participation have stayed the same, and Democrats have shown out in higher numbers. But the right, like Ben Shapiro was like, Obama lecturing us is how you got Trump in the first place, which is probably what he'd say if he was just worried that Obama talking to the country was like bad for his side.
Yeah. I mean, Obama galvanizing the country isn't what caused Trump to be elected.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. I mean, does it ever feel like, you know, these sort of like moments is just this endless feedback loop?
Yeah.
Where it's just the same people saying the same things over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't know what sort of analysis of actual impact these sort of like the conversation, like Obama makes a speech, the right gets upset, the left defends it. Like,
right.
It feels like this sort of is happening ad infinitum. Like, at what point does it still matter to everyone that Ben Shapiro criticized Obama? Like, I mean, does it still matter?
It still matters deeply to me because I am a Shapiro head. I'm a huge fan. No, I think his argument is disingenuous and bullshit. And
yeah,
I think more of a sign
right?
of, I think it's more of a sign of them being a little bit scared
like,
or worried about because this is the first time that Obama has come out and directly addressed the state of the nation and Trump in particular. And I think he did it in a way that wasn't lectury. Like, I think sometimes you can look at people's words and see what like they'll use the word that they want to be true. And like, so he wished that Obama came off as lecturing, but it was really like a unifying message and kind of rhetorically pretty smart and not lecture-y the way that he did it.
Yeah. And essentially this speech is the equivalent of a U up text from the one that got away. Like, you know, right. we did our bae, Barack, so dirty. And then he went on vacation. He lived his best life.
Right.
And, you know, he's finer than ever. And he came back and it was just like, it's like having a cathartic talk with an ex. Like, yeah, man, I know I fucked up.
Right.
You're like, yeah, you did fuck up. But hey, you can always change your life. Yeah. But not with me, though. I've moved on.
Yeah. Yeah. But he seemed to be really reaching his hand out to everybody except for the powerful and the privileged. So yeah. In a sense, he may have been lecturing Ben Shapiro because he might be one of the few people who's like, I am powerful and privileged. But, that's how I identify.
Do you think anybody's listening to Obama who doesn't already listen to Obama?
Yeah.
Like, do you think like any part of the right
I think they're,
who is actually open to listening to the man they literally despise?
I don't think that speech is for the right.
I know, but you know what I mean? I'm just like, so the people who are listening, though, are like, what new audience is he reaching?
I don't think he's probably reaching the 39% of people who are still supporting Trump, but Trump didn't win with only those people. Yeah. He also won with people who were Obama voters and then came over to the Trump side, and now Trump has lost part of the people who voted for him, like not a huge part, but still a percentage of them. And, you know, I think,
well, also the people at home, right? Yeah. Like the people who didn't vote in the last election, who, you know, who didn't feel as inspired. I feel like Obama has the gift of being a talented speaker. And unfortunately, we live in a country that sustains itself more on entertainment than it does on education. So people need their dicks hard to go vote, you know?
I guess, like, I still think, like, for me, I guess I always think that's a candidate issue. Mm. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it was.
If Obama makes a million great speeches, but you have a shitty candidate, people are still going to be less motivated to go vote.
But they'll still be motivated to vote if they're worried about the alternative. Although we've seen in the past with like elections like John Kerry, where it was like, we were voting against Bush and not
voting
for John
against
Kerry.
Is not a great
and
motivator,
yeah, it's
they
not.
Say.
Yeah. You want to vote for something. Yeah. He specifically tried to address that by connecting people's outrage to the act of voting as opposed to, and I think he even specifically said, like, this is not a popularity contest. Like, there's some great candidates out there, but like, this is not Coachella. It's not a rock concert. Like, you're not going there to be necessarily, inspired. It's you're going there to vote to affect change in the world around you. So I think what you're talking about is specifically something he was trying to address.
So there will be no Tupac holograms at the polls?
I guess not.
That's why I was going. We got like a cute...
It might be The Rock.
Right?
The Rock's very well run.
I voted stickers get people out. You can put that on your Instagram. Should we make those cuter?
Yeah.
Do we need a mural? Like I voted mural at every poll?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'll come take Instagram photos of you if you just go vote.
Let's move on to the U.S. Open, which was the U.S. Open final between Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka was unexpectedly also a really upsetting event where, you know, half of the crowd was booing.
I'd say
the
most
other
of
half
that crowd.
Was crying.
Yeah.
It was a lot. So, I mean, for people who didn't watch it, I mean, it was basically a situation where the judge, like the dude,
umpire,
penalized Serena for communicating with her coach. And then it just sort of snowballed from there with like penalized her for breaking her racket, then penalized her for like all these different things that I've seen so often happen in men's tennis.
You mean go unpunished?
Yeah, go unpunished. Right. Like, so common.
It was a because the game, or the match rather, was really shaping up to be really good because Naomi Osaka, who's 20 years old, was giving Serena the work in that first set. And I was like, yo, this is going to be a really good match. And that second set started and Serena was looking like, you know, Serena can come back in finals.
Right.
It's like her
She's
thing.
She's like a slow starter.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought, oh, we're gonna see like a fucking, like the three set just nail biter here. And then, yeah, the umpire just, his rigidity and just like, he just started taking her to task by the, like using the letter of the law to really get at her. And, you know, I think on one hand, a lot of people take her like, you know, she lost it or whatever. It's like, yo, first of all, have you seen like men's tennis before or tennis at
have
all?
Have you just seen sports?
Yeah. People are going to lose it because this is, they work their entire lives for moments like this. Yeah. And in Serena's case, to win her 24th Grand Slam and literally cement her place as a GOAT GOAT.
Right.
And yeah, it was a real shame because by the end, you know, she's a competitor. He was fucking her over with a lot of these calls and she lost it and it just exacerbated the situation and it completely ruined the moment for Naomi Osaka, who I feel like they do not talk enough about how good she looks as a player because a lot of this has been around, it's either been Serena's too hysterical or unsportsman or she was a victim of sexism, which I totally agree with that take. The unsportsmanlike shit, shut the fuck, miss me with that. But I feel like there needs to be more praise for Naomi Osaka too, because man, that was a shitty way for her to have to experience her first Grand Slam title. Yeah. I mean, like when they announced her as the winner, they fucking booed and you could just see it destroyed her to win. And for me, I was really conflicted during the whole thing because Naomi Osaka, I see a lot of myself as a black and knees person up there.
Right.
I was like, yo, I was so conflicted. I was like, Serena or the black and knees girl? Like, this is crazy. I've never had anything like this.
Yeah.
And it was a very, I could feel everything Naomi Osaka was as an American, as a Japanese person. She kept bowing to Serena because she has the utmost respect for Serena as a player. She even apologized for winning, which broke my heart.
Right.
That she could tell that the audience was not happy with the result, and she felt bad that she won. And, you know, she did a really great job. And
unfortunately, she was in the finals.
Yeah.
It's not like they just picked somebody from the crowd and you won.
And
like,
playing very well.
You got there.
Yeah.
You got there.
And I know that's probably got to suck, too, to know, like, your opponent was kind of psyched out by the ref and maybe didn't give you their best performance and it's not as satisfying.
Yeah.
But, man,
I hope she's back.
Who?
The one who won.
Naomi Osaka? Yeah. She ain't going anywhere.
Yeah. Billie Jean King said in her op-ed in the Washington Post about this that she's like the future of the game, basically.
That's great.
That it should have been just sort of a torch passing or the greatest of all time versus the up and coming next greatest. You know, for Serena, who during this tournament has faced the guy who heads up the French Open criticizing her and like saying he wouldn't let her wear her like cat suit anymore and just like all this shit where it's just sort of an outdated patriarchy kind of fucking with her. And she's struggling to be, you know, recognized as like the greatest athlete of all time without this like sexist double standard. And then like this dude comes and starts fucking, you know, getting in her face and like, you know, seemingly having a very clear like double standard and like very rigid against her. It just seemed, I don't know. I can see where she was coming from.
I mean, it's sexist. That cartoon that Australian person made today also paints it as racist as well.
What was the cartoon?
The guy made Serena look. You should go look at it. It's he made Serena just look like the angry black woman. He made Osaka look white. And basically painted it as
they got her like all stomping on her racket, having a tantrum.
And you know, that's another part of it too, where
of course
this man couldn't. Here's the thing, man. As somebody who loves sports, who has played sports, who plays sports, there is a certain thing that you recognize as a fan, as an athlete, and usually as a referee, that when it comes down to the finals, if you are the referee, the umpire, you got to have thicker skin.
Oh,
it's the fucking finals.
Yeah.
It's the final. You have to let some things go because this is literally the height of these guys and these women's professional careers,
right.
And everything is on the line. So the fact that he couldn't take a woman and a black woman saying you're a thief.
Right.
When, dude, I'm sure your wife has said stuff worse to you.
Right.
Like, oh, yeah. I remember.
I'm sure, like,
she didn't want to stand for it then either. So this is his opportunity.
This is his opportunity.
He's like,
right.
Do you see how high my seat is?
Yeah.
Do you see how high I am?
I finally can be in power.
Shut up, Jennifer.
Yeah. My name is Serena. So, you know, it's so amazing to me how thin of skin men get when it comes to a woman shutting you down.
Yeah.
Where you can take so much from other men. Because and I know we have this machismo thing about with each other where, man, you ain't gonna say that shit to me, blah blah blah. But how long does it take you to get to the point where you're like, I'm finally gonna do something?
Right.
Where all Serena had to do was say, you owe me an apology and you're a thief because you stole a point from me and you're gonna take a game away from her.
Right.
Right.
You're a bitch.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? That's literally the only thing that I can equate him as.
There were so many dimensions of gravity to this match, not just that it was these two women, especially being women of color in a sport that has traditionally been so dominated by white people. There was a lot going on. And the other thing about the coverage was they were so insistent on her just being Japanese. Mm-hmm. It was kind of bugging me out, too, because there's this other thing about being biracial where people sometimes cannot see you as being biracial, right?
They're
Japanese. But then no one was saying that her father is Haitian. You know what I mean? She is just as much Haitian as she is Japanese as she is American. And it was interesting to see because even there are times, for me personally, where I have to, like, people are like, oh, you're Japanese. Well, no, I'm half black, I'm half Japanese. Or people only choose to see a dimension of your racial identity when it suits a certain context. And it was, there was just a lot going on in that match. But at the end of the day, I'm just glad that, you know what, Naomi Osaka, you got your Grand Slam. You're 20 years old. You have your entire career ahead of you. Shout out to Serena, though. She tried her best to calm the whole crowd down by being like, yo, let's knock the booing off. But yeah, it was just a really, really bittersweet kind of moment. And no matter who you were supporting, like, there was no way to feel good about it.
It's unfortunate because I can't think of any other great. Oh, that's probably not true. But in modern sports time, I can't, and by modern, I mean like the past 25 to 30 years.
The last shit I can remember.
Yeah. I can't think of any great who has had to deal with what Serena has had to deal with in this tournament. Where, you know, you have an umpire calling you a cheater.
Right.
And you have, you know, this marring your professionalism and your athleticism and how great you are. Like, this is what happens. Like, this wouldn't have happened to the Tom Brady's of the world or the LeBron James's of the world or the Michael Jordan's or the Kobe's. Like, that, you know, the painted narrative would have been completely different if they had done the exact same thing that Serena Williams did.
Right.
And that's sad to me. That's so sad. Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. Tennis needs to work on itself. Let's put it that way. Because it's, she's the best thing that your sport has going.
Yeah, she revived, people fucking fuck with tennis because of Serena.
Yeah. By far. And,
I watched the ESPN clips because of Serena.
Yeah.
Look at you.
I don't watch the matches, but I watched the clips on ESPN.
But your Lacoste polo looks great.
I got a couple tennis rackets and I might swing once in a while.
But I use them as guitars for improv shows.
They props, you know what I'm saying, for sketch comedy, but I got them.
Speaking of inconceivable, I guess, kind of. The midterms are getting tighter. So a couple things to point out. First, the GOP is really scared of Beto O'Rourke.
And he's closing in.
Yeah.
Is he winning or is he doing good?
They're basically neck and neck at this point. Yeah. And it was not supposed to be like that. And now you have people like John Cornyn, who's the number two in the Senate, being like, basically kind of waving his arms to donors, being like, you know, for donors who are on the sidelines who think this is, this isn't a problem, it's a problem.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the funds from the party are, like, being diverted into Texas because a thing that should have been a fucking layup of a reelection.
Yeah, it's just so funny that Ted Cruz is so weird and unlikable. That, like,
well, I think I think Texans have finally realized.
Texas is like, well, this guy eats his own boogers. We can't have him in office. Yeah. Really, you know? Yeah. Like, come on, we're Texas. Like, we love guns and we love men, but this guy,
he's like, hey, Heidi and I. Like, you're just like, ugh.
You see the video of him trying to dunk?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Are you talking about the trampoline thing?
Oh, boy.
We were talking about trying to whether or not, is it intentional that he bailed? Because there's no, I don't
if
think
it's
there's
a bit, it makes me like him, like, 2%
I mean,
more?
He's Canadian, so right. I got to give him maybe some points in the irony.
If he knew and was like, okay, this will be funny, I'll like go up and like won't even come close. But if he thought he was going to nail that, it's so
he has,
amazing.
He, I mean, just looking at him, he looks like someone with the inflated sense of self and
right.
overestimation, like
the way
crazy
he, like,
self-confidence.
The ball, like,
yeah, that
to...
he's like, oh, watch me fucking smash.
See, here's the thing. I just think, I don't think he has any self-confidence. I think he's been beaten down and bullied his entire life.
Oh, that he's like...
But also, we're forgetting September 11th, anniversary of the day he got caught watching porn on Twitter.
Right.
Yeah,
big day for me.
Yeah.
because it was the first time I saw him as like a relatable human being that I could like gel with.
Who's watching right. cuck
yeah.
porn.
Well, you know, yeah, with women that look like his wife. Right. And I was like, you know what? You have your values.
You're
and
a real
you
guy.
Stick to them. He's not like these other fucking grifters, man. He like... You know what? I love my blonde white woman wife, and I will watch.
I will not stand up for her when Donald Trump talks shit about her.
And I will watch another man fuck her. Yeah. That is, but
yeah.
I also,
he's like Reek in Game of Thrones, where he's just been so beat down. He's like, yes.
That's funny.
Yeah. You
wait,
know,
so how did the Twitter thing happen? He like put a search in or put a,
I think he
a
liked,
link? To...
I think he searched for like, well, I don't know. There's like sex gifts at, you
right.
know, at Sexy F's Twitter, and he just liked it. And then someone noticed in his likes, like, why did Ted Cruz like this like 2.5 minute video of his wife, you know, fingering herself to him getting fucked or whatever? And then, or like people, their lookalikes or whatever.
Right, right.
And then it was up for like a while.
Right.
And then he came up with the whole like, I got hacked
right.
by someone super cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it showed up in his likes.
Right.
Yeah. But you know how they always,
know you could see those.
They always yeah. say about that politician, like, oh, George Bush won because he's someone you want to grab a beer with. It's like,
right.
that's the first time I've ever felt that about Ted Cruz.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you watch porn, I like porn.
Right.
We can
but
we
he's
have
in
a connection.
But
now.
He won't be upfront about it like you would. You know what I mean?
I could get
be
it
like,
out of
well,
him.
That was a mistake, and I'm very happy with Heidi.
Yo, three right. beers in, we're talking about BB Dubs.
Oh,
I
you think
promise
so?
You.
He's
I
like,
promise
hey,
you.
I like Pogs. He's like, all right, Yusuf.
I like Pogs. Some... fat ass white yeah. Jesus. That's what I call him.
Oh, man.
Pogs.
And then the other thing is the Senate Democrats. They're starting to fucking start feeling themselves, and there's now they're catching a whiff of a blue nami, not even a blue wave, where they think the Senate could go to the Democrats.
Icarus,
now,
let's not go crazy.
Yeah, yeah,
here,
yeah.
Guys.
I'm already. As we can tell, we've already been very apprehensive about even acknowledging the polls, even though like there's like we're seeing in real time that a lot of these Democratic candidates are winning. But yeah, it looks like. When they do the math, like because now Cook Political Report has moved a few more races into toss-ups, which means like it's a 50-50 shot. If the Democrats win every race that is in the toss-up category and even lose in Texas, they would have a 52-48 majority. But again, if the Republicans just win even two, like it doesn't even matter. But, you know,
yeah,
it's, there's it shows you that there's clearly a lot. There's still so much going on. There's still plenty of time in terms of, well, not plenty of time, but there's still time left that we might see something interesting.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Super producer Nick was just pointing out again this morning, like there does seem to be a trend where like these far left, more populist candidates really seem to be overperforming the polls. But still, I think it's underrepresenting the young.
I think pollsters
people.
A little shook, too, because they fucked up so bad last time.
Right.
And I think
in
also, too,
direction.
We're also less likely to believe them. Like. I'm like I have like baggage from it where even if the polls say something right, I'm like, nah, that ain't gonna happen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or even if it's bad, I'm like, I can't trust that.
Yeah.
And even though the good shit is happening, like verifiably with a lot of these big wins, like of Andrew Gillum and Ayanna Pressley, et cetera, I'm still just like, you never know. Cause we still have that trauma of being like,
right.
Yeah, this should work. Yeah, it looks okay. This seems the numbers look right, but don't know till, you know, November.
Yeah. But Gillum was supposed to be down by like 10 points and ended up winning, and Ayanna Pressley won by 20 points when she was down 13 in the polls.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's Democrat versus Democrat, but it does seem to skew things left if you're just looking at the polls.
Yeah, there are a lot more like polls coming out that just show a lot of Republican incumbents like it's tightening up with like Democratic challengers. So, you know, we'll see.
Right.
That's why everybody got to vote, no matter where you live.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. So Facebook is garbage and everyone should leave.
Yeah.
The end. And so Facebook, there's a couple of things coming out recently. First, Narc Sucker Nerd has a big fake news problem on his platform. And he tried to make it better by hiring all these legit fact checkers to vet, you know, the most highly circulated stories. This seems like just the obvious fucking, you know, solution to all of their problems.
Right.
Except the right is not having that shit.
Well, yeah, because he had like people who do fact checking for a living and come from like think tanks that are like about journalistic integrity, like, you know, PolitiFact or factcheck.org. But conservatives are like, well, hold on. All they do is just call out all these conservative articles. This is not fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is bullshit.
Right.
Because that's not fair.
Essentially, because
this is what we're saying is true. So he caved. And now the Weekly Standard, which is a fucking very conservative, you know, co-founded by Bill Kristol site that has all kinds of op-eds, like, you know, fucking Fucker Carlson writes in there from time to time. They have them doing fact checking on stories that are from the left. And they've like they were putting like certain articles having like liberal bias that didn't at all, purely because they were just taking things literally from like a headline and being like, well, that literally didn't happen, so this is a lie, without taking nuance into it, without actually going over like what the story was about, and just simply slapping that on. And then Facebook actually put that up there and like, this is kind of shady.
Yeah.
And it was causing a lot of problems because it brings up this whole thing of like, why is he caving to this whining? Because when they're actually fact-checking these stories from like far-right websites that are actually dealing in non-fact and misinformation, that's because that's what the facts are. Yeah.
Right.
But then to go and be like, well, let them have their weird like right-wing rag take a look at it. Of course, they're going to try and obscure things or just mischaracterize a lot of articles that are critical of some of the right-wing politics. But yeah.
Yeah.
Remember when things were just listicles? Wasn't that nice?
Yeah.
You're telling me, sister.
Oh, my God. I miss, like, just being, like, having my family members, like, wishing me happy birthday who I haven't heard from.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it should just be.
Or just quizzes. Like, which?
I'm off. I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do it anymore. Because the thing is the gaslighting is constant. And if you allow people to just pouty dance and be like, that's not right. What about me? It's like, that's not what this is about.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Like,
if I'd use that argument as a kid where I'm like, well, that's not fair.
Yeah.
You know, my teacher said to me, I had a teacher who, whenever we said this in her class, you go, that's not fair. She'd say, you know, life is not fair.
Mm.
And dead any complaint we had as kids. And we learned real quick not to complain about shit like that. Yeah. But I think the thing is that I think just because they're so noisy about it and they think that because they've misled so many people who are of their thinking, to come out and be like, well, yeah, Facebook is censoring or whatever. I mean, they are doing that to even far left things too. Don't get me wrong. But we can't actually have a touchstone for like what is actual fact, like a foundation for reality for both sides to agree upon.
Yeah.
Because if their version of fact, which is usually misinformation, is called like, then they're saying, well, that's a liberal bias. We're completely restructuring and reframing this conversation about like liberal versus conservative when we're talking about fact versus fiction.
Yeah.
And it's a slippery slope.
Yeah. There's a New Yorker article where Evan Osnos, one of their best writers, got access to Zuckerberg and the Facebook campus for like the last year, basically. And it's pretty interesting. There's like a couple really alarming things where you see Zuckerberg like knows about all those problems happening in like India and overseas. And he's like, yeah, well, I hate that this problem's happening and we're working on it, but we've got to hire the right people. And it's just like he deals with everything in the same way where he's like, I acknowledge the problem, but however, on this other thing, and there's no DEFCON one, like, you know, this, we need to get shit done. Like we're in an emergency situation. And they point out that it's probably, you know, he has been in this industry that is criticized by outsiders, like his testifying on Capitol Hill, like in front of all of these senators who don't know what the fuck they're talking about, is part of the problem, because he has spent his life being criticized by people who don't have the knowledge base to actually make good criticism. So he just has this mode of dealing with criticism. And that he applies that even to when people are making good points, essentially,
right.
is one of the arguments in the article. But, I mean, just a couple of the memorable details. Facebook has more users than Christianity does at this point.
Users.
Yes.
Hey, I'm a frequent user of Christ.
Yes. And the design of Christianity is so simple and intuitive.
I'm so fucked up off salvation right now, fam.
But all about that Jesus
all
juice,
about it,
right?
Yeah, all about that.
It has the most customers an American company has ever had in the history of, like, capitalism. And that is the result of something. So in 2007, they basically saw the size of their user base plateau, which had been, like, it was the same size that other social networks like MySpace, like other, all other social networks had hit this one size and then just, like, not been able to grow any larger. And so Facebook basically made their business a cult of growth. Like, they had a growth team that was, like, the cool smart kids on campus, and everybody, like, was just, like, wanted to know what the growth team was up to.
How do we grow it?
That was it. It was, like, a very single-mindedness of focus to the whole company. And he basically, I think the best and most clarifying line in the article is, the cult of growth leads to the curse of bigness, because all of their problems can be seen as just size related. Like, right. you just have so many people now that you can't regulate all these problems. And they're trying to solve the problem of, like, what is hate speech? What is free speech? And Zuckerberg specifically says at a certain point, like, you know, we used to be able to write an algorithm to spot a nipple. And, like, that was easier to stop pictures that had nipples in them.
Right.
Nipples are very offensive, guys. Very Nazis, but Nazis, I'm
right.
just saying.
But you can't write an algorithm to stop Nazis. So that's,
yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's
that
fair.
Is the problem.
Just kick them off. Wait, when did they open up Facebook to people who didn't have a college email?
Yeah.
I think it was before 2007. It must have been like 2000.
I think it's around
think it
that time.
Because I had to have, I graduated, not to date myself, but 08. And I think maybe 08 or 09 is when
something
they
around there.
Because
I remember feeling salty about it. Because I was like, yo, you can't get Facebook unless you got that .edu.
That .edu.
That proper college email. And then when, like, they let all these motherfuckers
and then
your
in, mom gets it.
I was like, why did I go to college then? I did it just to flex on Facebook.
Right.
But yeah, I wonder if that, I'm sure that must have factored into it. Like, when they hit that plateau, or like, oh, well, we're only limiting it to college students.
Yeah. And then, like, after that, after you're done with college, what's the use for it?
Right.
You know what I mean? If it's only going to be available for college students.
Cut to 2016.
I can't imagine they were like, how do we solve this size problem? They were like, what if we allowed people who weren't just college students? Yeah. I think it was after that they had the issue because. Yeah, like they said that a big thing was hiring people who spoke other languages and just making it more user-friendly to other countries. And basically.
2006, September 26, right. 2006, when they opened it to everyone age 13 and older with a valid email address.
There you go.
Boom.
How do you even, like, know if a kid is 13, though? Do they just click a box? Is that how you do it?
I'm pretty.
Miles,
yeah.
you're good at that, right?
Sorry.
You're good at guessing people's ages.
I'm great at guessing people's ages, and do not watch any past episodes of To Catch a Predator. No, that's a joke. But I'm pretty sure it was just like put in your fucking birthday.
Yeah, and your AOL email.
Yeah. Like when I used to look at like liquor websites in like high school, and they're like, "What's your age?" And I'd be like, 1969.
What would you find on liquor websites?
I was really into Hypnotic.
Liquor,
and I remember like there was
what is Hypnotic?
Hypnotic was that blue,
like,
shit.
Blue,
it looked
tropical,
like blue
passion
shit.
Fruit.
You mix it with Hennessy, it was Incredible Hulk. And like I was fucked up because it was in all the rap videos, and I was like, yo.
So you were just trying to buy it?
Well, I was trying to, at first, I was like, what is this?
Oh,
you know what I mean?
It's blue, because
I saw
it's
it in
opaque.
The, yeah, because I saw it in videos, and like I wasn't really around liquor stores enough to quite put it all together. And
it's
like,
mango-based, right?
It's probably just, it's unicorn frap-flavored drink. Right.
It basically took the spot of Alizé.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's the same sort of very fruity shit.
But it's blue.
Yeah, exactly. And that color had people being really into it. Yeah. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I remember I thought Facebook was going to be the solution to all of the internet's problems when it was first like hitting, because it was like so much of the internet was just anonymous trolls.
Right.
And like, so people connecting themselves to, like, that was something that had happened over in Korea, that helped make the Korean internet a better place to exist is because, like, they just made it mandatory that you connect your, like, online activity to who you were as a person and, like, right. basically your citizen ID. And so I thought Facebook was going to do that, but turns out,
yep.
as we saw in that comment section yesterday where it was all Facebook people commenting under their Facebook identities and just being super racist, people just don't give a fuck.
No.
No. Everybody thinks they can do whatever they want now.
Yeah.
They just have a mouthpiece for it. I just miss the Facebook that if you wanted to go and look at somebody's Facebook, you had to go to their page and that was it. There was no updating system.
Right,
like
right.
That when Twitter came out and like, there, you know, you have that stream of just what people are freaking thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now everyone's like, well, I can comment on that. If right. you just, I can't read a comment section even at like goodhomemagazine.com. Yeah. Like, it's yeah. just a bummer. I just yeah. refuse to read any comments.
Yeah, their thoughts on Wicker are
just aggressive
so yeah.
and rude.
I know.
And not very
I, for
nice.
One, still love rattan furniture.
I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah, I don't even, I can't stand Facebook anymore in general. I don't
I'm
use
done.
It. So don't try to find me because I don't use it.
I'm gonna find you.
Okay, now. That's fine.
One of the things the article said, though, is they're buying Instagram at the time was like seen as completely overpaid for it, and now it's viewed as like the smartest purchase in the history
right.
of like online retail, or like in the history
of online retail since I
Silicon
bought that,
Valley.
That donut pool
floor. Yeah, not online retail. Yeah. In the history of Silicon Valley. All right, that's gonna do it for this week's weekly Zeitgeist. Please like and review the show if you like the show. Means the world to Miles. He needs your validation, folks. I hope you're having a great weekend, and I will talk to you Monday. Bye.